Thank you, Lee, and thanks to all of the organizers for making this wonderful event possible. I've been enjoying it immensely myself so far. For my very brief lecture, I'm biting off a small piece of the topic addressed at this conference. The problem is, what are we to make of the new contributions from brain science when we think about personal identity, free will, moral responsibility, and our legal system? We've heard from Adrian Raines about brain defects that are associated with higher rates of criminal behavior. These cases rightly raise questions about the extent of moral and legal responsibility in so-called normal cases. An extreme reaction is to conclude that nothing we do is really our own doing, but rather that our brains make us do them. I call this an extreme reaction because over the long history of deliberations in ethics and law, our culture has regularly made distinctions between degrees of responsibility. Surely the developments in neuroscience offer both provocations and resources to fine-tune these judgments, as Adam Kolber has already described. But is there reason to abandon the distinctions altogether? My answer will be no. Two worries about human determinism, genetic and neurobiological, are both instances of a broad thesis that may be called causal reductionism. Causal reductionism in general is the claim that the behavior of all complex entities is determined by the behavior of their parts. This is the case in many of the systems we understand, such as mechanical clocks. These are designed so that the movement of the parts determines the behavior of the whole. The problem is that there has been a tendency throughout the modern period to assume that when we turn to entities that are too complex to understand in detail, they also must be determined by their parts. In the human sphere, the significant parts are brain components, and so there has arisen a very sensible worry, namely, that the laws of neurobiology are inevitably determining all of our thoughts and actions. Since brains and behavior are too complex fully to understand, the best way, and perhaps the only way, is to take on the thesis of causal reductionism in general. This is the part of the topic of the conference that I'll address. A caveat is in order, though. Even this small bite is too much for a 35-minute lecture. My plan will be to introduce some new and useful conceptual resources from philosophy. First, the term emergence describes the processes by which complex systems can build themselves by linking together simpler components. Second, there are two comparable terms, whole part constraint and downward causation, that are used to describe the ways in which broader systems, wholes, or higher level, more complex systems, can actually affect the causal capacities of their own parts. These emergent and somewhat autonomous systems require a third development. We need a new language to describe their differences from entities that are determined by their parts. Over the past generation, a variety of research projects, cybernetics, information theory, far from equilibrium thermodynamics, and nonlinear mathematics, have merged into what is called complex systems theory. Some scholars describe these developments as a paradigm change across all of the sciences. I argue that this is just what we need to explain why it is usually not the case that our neurons made us do it. So, section one, responses to causal reductionism. The most significant criticisms of causal reductionism fall into three historical stages. First, an early emergentist movement from approximately 1920 through 1950. Second, the exploration of the concept of downward causation, beginning in the 1970s. And we are now in a third phase in which the new conceptual resources of complex systems theory are helping to explain more clearly how higher level, more complex systems emerge from their components and in turn exert downward control over some of their own components. The idea of emergence was proposed in philosophy of biology in the 1920s. It was an alternative both to mechanist reductionist accounts of the origin of life and to vitalism. Vitalists claimed that in order to get life from inorganic matter, something like a vital force needed to be added. Emergentists, such as Roy Wood Sellers, argued that the increasingly complex organization, as one ascends the hierarchy of systems, accounts for the appearance of new kinds of entities with causal capacities that cannot be reduced to physics. The organic emerges from the physical, so too do the levels of the mental or conscious, the social, the ethical, and the religious or spiritual. Sellers claimed that early in the modern period, the ontological imagination was stultified by the picture of microscopic billiard balls. In contrast, he argued that organization and wholes are genuinely significant. They are not mere aggregates of elementary particles. Reductive materialism overemphasizes the stuff in contrast to the organization. There is energy, there is the fact of pattern, there are all sorts of intimate relations. Matter or stuff needs to be supplemented by terms like integration, pattern, function. With hindsight, we can see that Sellers and some of the early emergentists were exactly right. However, their arguments did not prevail at that time against the reductionist philosophers of science. In the 1970s, psychologist Roger Sperry and philosopher Donald Campbell both wrote about downward or top-down causation. Sperry sometimes wrote of the higher level entity or system overpowering the causal forces of the component entities. This rightly raised worries regarding the compatibility of his account with adequate respect for the basic sciences. Campbell doesn't write of overpowering lower level processes, but instead provides a non-mysterious account of a larger system of causal factors having a selective effect on lower level entities and processes. His example is the role of natural selection in producing the remarkable jaw structures of ants and termites. He intends to illustrate four theses. The first two give due recognition to bottom-up accounts of causation. First, all processes at the higher level are restrained by and act in conformity to the laws of the lower levels, including physics. Second, the achievements at higher levels require for their implementation specific lower level mechanisms and processes. Explanation is not complete until these micro mechanisms have been specified. The third and fourth theses represent the perspective of downward causation. Third, he says, biological evolution in its meandering exploration of segments of the universe encounters laws operating as selective systems which are not described by the laws of physics and inorganic chemistry. Fourth, where natural selection operates through life and death at higher levels of organization, the laws of the higher level selective system determine in part the distribution of lower level events and substances. Description of an intermediate level phenomenon is not completed by describing its possibility and implementation in lower level terms. Its presence, prevalence, or distribution, all needed for a complete explanation of biological phenomena, will often require reference to laws at a higher level of organization as well." End quote. Now, it appears that very little was written on downward causation until the 1990s. Robert Van Gulik made an important contribution by spelling out in more detail than Campbell's an account based on selection. The reductionist thesis, according to van Gulik, is that the causal roles associated with the classifications employed by higher level sciences are entirely derivative from the causal roles of their underlying physical constituents. Van Gulik counters that even though the events and objects picked out by the higher level sciences are composites of physical constituents, the causal powers of such an object are not determined solely by the physical properties of the constituents and the laws of physics. They are also determined by the organization of those constituents within the composite. It is just such patterns of organization that are picked out by the predicates of the higher level sciences. These patterns have downward causal efficacy in that they can affect which causal powers of their constituents are activated. He says, a given physical constituent may have many causal powers, but only some subsets of them will be active in a given situation. The larger context, that is the pattern of which it is a part, may affect which of its causal powers get activated. Thus, the whole is not any simple function of its parts, since the whole at least partially determines what contributions are made by its parts. End quote. Such patterns and entities are stable features of the world, often despite variations or exchanges in their underlying physical constituents. Many patterns are self-sustaining or self-reproducing in the face of perturbing physical forces that might otherwise destroy them. For example, DNA patterns. That is, selective activation of the causal capacities of the pattern's parts may contribute to the maintenance and preservation of the pattern itself. These points illustrate that higher order patterns can have a degree of independence from their underlying physical realizations and can exert what might be called downward causal influences without requiring any objectionable form of emergentism by which higher order properties would alter the underlying laws of physics. Higher order properties act by selective activation of physical powers and not by their alteration. From van Gulik's account, we can see that evading causal reductionism will require the recognition that higher level entities and systems have emerged from lower, and that these entities can be somewhat independent of the causal processes of their constituents, thereby manifesting new higher level causal capacities. The sort of organization and selection of lower level causal processes that van Gulik describes calls for new concepts, and in fact, calls for a paradigm change across the sciences. This is the shift from thinking in mechanistic terms to thinking in systems terms. So, section 2, complex adaptive systems theory. Systems thinking has been developing over the past half century, although it has only recently begun to have a significant impact. Systems theory draws from a number of sources. There are significant roots in general systems theory, developed from the 1950s through the 1970s. Another early source was the study of cybernetics. Current contributions come from information theory, nonlinear mathematics, the study of chaotic and self-organizing systems, and non-equilibrium thermodynamics. Examples of the systems of interest range from autocatalytic processes at the most basic to weather patterns, insect colonies, social organizations, and, of course, human brains. I attempt to set out here some of the essential concepts involved in this change, and then I will illustrate them with the example of an ant colony. I will then report ever so briefly on work I've done with my colleague Warren Brown in tying systems theory to the assorted abilities that go into our capacity for morally responsible action. Several authors call for what we might call a shift in ontological emphases. Alicia Guerrero says that one has to give up the traditional Western philosophical bias in favor of things with their intrinsic properties for an appreciation of processes and relations. Frances Heiligen argues that the basic ontological categories for systems theory are agents and actions. Systems have permeable boundaries, allowing for the transport of materials, energy, and information. The boundary is a matter of the tighter coupling of its components with one another relative to their coupling with entities outside the system. The crucial components of complex systems are not things, but processes. And this is such a key that I want to read it again. The crucial components of complex systems are not things, but processes. So, for example, from a systems perspective, a mammal is composed of a circulatory system, a reproductive system, and so forth, not of carbon, hydrogen, calcium. The organismic level of description is largely decoupled from the atomic level. Systems are different from both mechanisms and aggregates in that the properties of the components themselves are dependent on their being parts of the system in question. Philosophers distinguish between internal and external relations. External relations do not affect the nature of the relata, but internal relations are partially constitutive of the characteristics of the relata. An essential assumption of the predominant modern worldview was that the world is composed of things related to one another externally. Systems theory takes the relations among the constituent processes of a system to be internal. Systems range from great stability to wild fluctuation. This is due to the fact that complex systems are nonlinear. That is, the current state affects the development of each future state. The difference in stability is due to the extent to which the system is sensitive to slight variations in initial conditions, and also to the extent to which there are feedback processes that either do or do not dampen out fluctuations. Systems at the extremes of this spectrum of stability are not of great interest to systems theory. For example, consider a thermostatically controlled heating system. Now, this is not a complex system, but I'm just using it as an example. A thermostatically controlled heating system is very stable, but it produces no novelty because it involves a negative feedback system that keeps the temperature within a set range. Imagine, in contrast, a reverse thermostat that provides positive feedback such that the colder or hotter a building becomes, the more it increases the cooling or heating. This system is unpredictable, but not likely to last long. Thus, the systems of interest are those in the middle of the spectrum. Chaotic systems are now familiar to most folks. They result from having a sensitivity to initial conditions that falls into a narrow range, and their behavior consequently falls into a predictable range of states. More interesting are those at the edge of chaos. Here the system has the freedom to explore new possibilities and may actually jump to a newer and higher form of organization. They are characterized by goal-directedness, at least insofar as they operate to maintain themselves. In the process of self-maintenance, they may create their own components. For example, in an autocatalytic reaction, molecule A catalyzes molecule B, which catalyzes more of molecule A. The process will stabilize at some point unless additional materials are introduced into the system. In order for the system to maintain itself, the internal dynamics must determine which molecules are fit to be imported into the system and survive. We reach a new level of complexity in systems that operate not on the basis of predetermined goals and feedback loops, for example, the homeostatic systems in an organism, but also have the capacity to select their own goals and thereby adapt to new circumstances. These are called complex adaptive systems. When such systems also have some sort of memory, a way of storing information about what has or has not worked in the past, for example, the genome, there is a heightened ability for the system, here the species, to increase its adaptation over time. The capacity for memory in individual organisms brings us to the point of being able to speak of information and meaning. This adaptive selection opens the possibility of learning and the emergence of novel behavior based in neural plasticity and the ongoing influence of events outside the system, that is, outside the organism. Complex adaptive systems theory has dramatic consequences for understanding causation. While ordinary efficient causation is presupposed, systems theory developed specifically because such causation has turned out to be inadequate to describe these complex kinds of systems. This is in part because complex systems operate on information as much as on energy and matter. More important is the fact that relations among the components of a system need to be thought of in terms of constraints. An efficient cause makes something happen. A constraint reduces the number of things that can happen, and as a result of the fact that the components are internal, that can happen, as a result of the fact that the components are internally related to one another, such that a change in one automatically changes the other. Alicia Warrero says, "The concept of a constraint in science suggests not an external force that pushes, but a thing's connection to something else, as well as to the setting in which the object is situated." More generally, then, constraints pertain to an object's connection with the environment or its embeddedness in that environment. They are relational properties rather than primary qualities in the object itself. Objects in aggregates do not have constraints. Constraints only exist when an object is part of a unified system. From information theory, Warrero employs a distinction between context-free and context-sensitive constraints. For example, in successive throws of a die, the numbers that have come up previously do not constrain the probabilities for the current throw. Beware gamblers. The constraints on the die's behavior are context-free. In contrast, in a card game, the constraints are context-sensitive. The chances of, say, drawing an ace at any point in the game are sensitive to history because the rules of the game, the number of cards in the deck, and so forth, create relations among the possible outcomes such that the probability of one occurrence is related to all of the others. This account suggests that a better term in place of downward causation is actually whole-part constraint. The higher-level system, the whole, does not exert efficient, forceful causation on its components. Rather, global features of the system are such that a change in one component changes the probability of the occurrence of other lower-level events. And here's an explanation of van Gulik's selection. Due to the role of probability in complex systems, it's necessary to do away with the sharp distinction between determinism and indeterminism, that is, quantum indeterminacy or complete randomness. The appropriate middle term is propensity, a term coined by Karl Popper to mean an irregular or non-necessitating causal disposition of an object or system to produce some result or effect. An understanding of the concept of a propensity has been aided by the study of nonlinear mathematics and especially chaotic systems. It begins with a visual or imaginary state space or phase space, which is an n-dimensional space in which a trajectory represents possible transitions from one state of the system to another. Chaotic systems theory introduced the concept of a strange attractor to describe the development of chaotic systems over time. This is a shape in phase space that depicts the boundaries within which the system can be found during its evolution. From the concept of a strange attractor, the idea of an ontological landscape has developed. This is a topographical map in which valleys represent areas in phase space in which the system is likely to stay. Peaks represent states in which the system will only be found as a result of a major perturbation, such as the injection of a great deal of energy. So the system has a propensity to remain within the valleys. The topography represents a summation of the general effects of a vast number of contextually constrained interactions among the system's component processes. Section 3, from complex systems to moral responsibility. My project over the last 10 years has been to write a book with Warren Brown, a cognitive neuroscientist, titled Did My Neurons Make Me Do It? Philosophical and Neurobiological Perspectives on Moral Responsibility and Free Will. Time for a commercial break, on sale, out in front. Please buy many copies. In our work, Brown and I first thought that the defeat of neurobiological reductionism by means of an account of downward causation would be sufficient to account for mental causation and thus dissolve threats to moral responsibility and free will. Reading new works on complex adaptive systems, however, convinced us that we still had far to go in order to give an account of how humans can become causes in their own right. Complex adaptive systems theory postulates that such systems become causal players in their own right, partly independent of the behavior of their components, selectively influenced by their environment, and capable of pursuing their own goals. To illustrate how the concepts drawn from complex systems theory operate, Brown and I chose the simplest complex system we could imagine, an ant colony. Harvester ant colonies consist of a queen and other worker ants. The worker ants are specialized. Some forage for food, others carry away trash, and still others carry dead ants away from the colony. Ant colonies show various sorts of intelligent behavior. If the colony is disturbed, worker ants near the queen will carry her down an escape hatch. A harvester ant colony in the field will not only ascertain the shortest distance to food sources, it will also prioritize them based on their distance and ease of access. In response to changing external conditions, worker ants switch from nest building to foraging to raising ant pupae. The means by which this happens is based on ant rules, such as if a forager encounters more than 3 pheromone trails from other foragers within a certain period of time, she returns to the nest. Colonies develop over time. Successful colonies last up to 15 years, the lifespan of the queen, even though the worker ants live only a year. The colonies themselves go through stages. Young colonies are more fickle than older ones. Younger colonies are also more aggressive. It is tempting to try to explain the behavior of the colony reductionistically. Knowledge of some of the ant rules gives the impression that the behavior of the colony is entirely determined bottom up. One can imagine that each ant has built-in laws governing its behavior, and one can imagine at a molecular neural level an account such as smell of fourth forager within 1 minute causes return to the nest. So the typical causal agent is not the system as a whole, the environment, but a few molecules of a pheromone embedded in the ant's receptor system. And the assumption is that if one had all of this information, then one could predict or explain the behavior of the whole colony. Now, consider an alternative systems theory description of the phenomena. The colony as a whole is certainly describable as a system. It is bounded but not closed. It is a self-sustaining pattern. The shift in perspective required by a systems approach is to see the colony's components as a set of interrelated functional systems, not a queen plus other ants, but rather an organization of processes such as reproduction, foraging, nest building. It is a self-organized system that runs on information. It produces and maintains its own functional systems in that the relations among the ants constrain them to fulfill the roles of forager, nest builder, etc. In addition, it has a high degree of autonomy vis-a-vis the environment. The crucial shift in perspective is from thinking in terms of causes, that is, nothing will happen unless something makes it happen, to thinking in terms of both bottom-up causes and constraints. That is, a variety of behaviors are possible, and the important question is what constricts the possibilities to observe to give the observed results. Now I'm going to move on from ant colonies, because ant colonies have the level of complexity involved that's comparable to the very simplest of multi-celled organisms, those without a nervous system. To get from ants to human consciousness, to human conscious choices, it's necessary first to consider the ways in which all complex organisms differ from simple ones. The variables that lead to increases in the capacity for self-causation include modifiability of parts, neural complexity, behavioral flexibility, and increasing ability to acquire information. In systems terms, this involves functional specialization of components and a high level of flexible coupling of those components. As we move away from rudimentary animal behavior toward humans, we see a vast increase in brain size, tighter coupling of neurons, structural complexification, recurrent neural interconnections, and complex functional networks that are hypothesized to be the source of consciousness. But still there's the question of what distinguishes intelligent, self-conscious, and morally responsible choices from the flexibility and autonomy of the other higher animals. Brown and I argued that the two crucial developments are symbolic language and the related capacity to evaluate one's own behavior and cognition. Thus, the remainder of the story about how we get to moral responsibility and some form of free will involves, first, consideration of the charge that brain science cannot make sense of linguistic meaning. We argue that the supposed mysteries of meaning and intentionality are a product of leftover Cartesian assumptions regarding the inwardness of mental acts and the passivity of the knower. If instead we consider the mental in terms of action in the social world, there's no more mystery to how the word chair, for instance, hooks onto the world than there is in how one learns to sit in a chair. We consider what is known so far about the neural capacities needed for increasingly complex use of symbols. Symbolic language, in fact, quite sophisticated symbolic language, is a prerequisite for both reasoning and morally responsible action. We then turn to the question, how does reason get its grip on the brain? That is, we turn to the role of reason in human thought and action. A powerful reductionist argument is the lack so far of a suitable account of mental causation, that is, of the role of reason in brain processes. The problem is often formulated as the question of how the mental properties of brain events can be causally efficacious. We reformulate the problem instead as two questions. How is it that the series of mental neural events come to conform to rational as opposed to merely causal patterns? And what difference does the possession of mental capacities make to the causal efficacy of an organism's interaction with its environment? These moves put us in position to consider the central theme of our book, a philosophical analysis of the concept of morally responsible action. Here we adopt an account of moral agency worked out by Alistair MacIntyre. Morally responsible action depends on the ability to evaluate that which moves one to act in light of some concept of the good. We then investigate the cognitive prerequisites for such action, among which we include sense of self, the ability to predict and represent the future, and high-order symbolic language. Finally, we bring to bear our argument to the effect that organisms are often the causes of their own behavior, together with our work on language, rationality, and responsibility, in order to make the claim that we have eliminated one of the worries that seems to threaten our conception of ourselves as free agents, namely neurobiological reductionism, the worry that my neurons made me do it. Thank you.
But I don't understand about Dowman causation, how that's supposed to work. So you seem to say that there can be downward causation and yet the laws that govern the parts are not changed or overridden or anything mm-hmm. like that. So what difference is the system as a whole making then? Where is it making a difference? I mean, if all the atoms are in the locations that they are in because they are faithfully conforming to the laws of physics, then how come the organism as a whole is not in that same place? How could it be, you know, somewhere else?
The key term that I've used is selection. When you've got a system like an ant colony, the ants are genetically identical, and so there's no difference amongst them in terms of that could be described by chemistry, physics, chemistry, and biology. What makes the ant colony a complex system that maintains itself over time is that the global properties of the colony produce constraints on which of the capacities the ants all possess the same capacities to do work. But it's the global property of the colony that selects which of the behaviors each ant is going to exercise. And so, for instance, forager density is a global property of the colony, and it's the density of the foragers that increases the likelihood that forager A is going to run across three more foragers within the specified length of time, and then that keys her to go back and do some other kind of work in the colony. So it's not violating any of the laws of biology, chemistry, or physics. It's simply that within the system, the ants are related to one another in such a way that you have to look to the global characteristics of the colony in order to explain why ant A switched from doing this behavior to doing that behavior.
Hey, I just have one follow-up question. So when the global feature of the colony makes a difference to which of the individual ants' capacities is exercised on a given occasion, does that happen via the production of changes internal to the ant? Does that happen without any change in the neuronal activity in the ant?
No, they have primitive neural systems about the same as a fruit fly. And obviously, whenever an organism with a neural system detects something, there's some change going on in its little head, however minimal that is. But it's something coming from the environment. The pheromone molecules locking in its nose, if they have noses, that produces the brain change, that produces the change in behavior.
Okay.
I would bring attention to the work of David Sloan Wilson, who makes a distinction between correspondence truth, and he calls it, and I actually say correspondence reality, and he describes as adaptive reality, and that is adaptive reality relates to survival and well-being. And you don't get to that until you get to the life sciences. You get no barriers in chemistry or physics. And I would also bring into mention medical ethics, which begins with the assumption of a respect for human dignity. And I would remind people that when they took geometry, you never even proved your initial assumptions in mathematics. They've always been by definition. But it understands, medical ethics understands human nature to be multidimensional, taking into concern the individual, the social, the consequential or utilitarian, as well as the anthropological aspects of human nature. And that would seem to correlate with what you're describing as the different functional aspects of human nature. And in fact, that would give us some concept of free will, because what we have is a power in the mind or some kind of balance of consciousness where we at least have the perspective of free will, because we're trying to integrate all these things.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm a bit unclear as to how the feedback within a system and the external input from the outside of the system impacts the individual behaviors at lower levels within the system. So, and how that reflects on the system's ability to affect itself. So within the ant colony, it seems as though the external conditions of the system are governed by similar rules that are already existing within the colony. So in what way does it really affect itself?
Well, the each species of ant operates differently. And so you're going to have to study, you know, each particular type in order to devise what we're calling the ant rules. What is built into them biologically, neurologically, that plays a role in their adapting their behavior in order to maintain the colony. But if you only knew that, and you took a bunch of ants and just dropped them on the floor, you would not have an ant colony. Because while their little nervous systems are intact and their inherited ant rules are intact, you don't have the structure that mutually constrains the ants in order to coordinate their behavior with one another. One of the reasons that they're so interesting, that a dynamic system is so interesting, is that it does have the capacity to adapt to different environments. And so colonies will be, you can have two different ant colonies in different quality environments, and they'll have to behave differently in order to maintain a colony that's very much like the neighboring colony. Does that help answer your question? Rephrase it, say some more.
How does it seem that this system is governed by different rules than the constituents? I mean, I understand that the ants would not be able to control their behavior effectively outside of the constraints of the system, but I guess I don't really understand how this system causes changes within itself.
Well, most of what it's doing is maintaining itself. What it's actually doing is maintaining its stability over time, despite, for instance, someone coming along and kicking the ant hill, or despite moving another ant colony into its vicinity, or any other, all sorts of ways that you can perturb the colony. What's interesting about it is that it goes back to behaving the way that it did before. Now, there are some changes over time. I skipped over a paragraph. Younger colonies are more aggressive, And so if ants from one colony encounter ants from another colony, they're more likely to conflict, whereas if an older colony, they're more likely to turn around and go home. And younger colonies are more, there's more fluctuation in their behavior than in older colonies. They tend to settle down in stable patterns. And that interestingly illustrates characteristics of all complex systems over time. They tend to have more fluctuation in the beginning and then settle into more or less stable states. And of course, our brains, in connection with our environment and our behavior, are in fact complex adaptive systems, then you've got an explanation for the truism that it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks.
I had some kind of some very basic metaphysics questions about how you're looking at things. So I think I heard you say that, let's say, organisms were not composed of atoms, but were composed of systems. Is that what you said?
Well, it's not that they're not composed of atoms, but the fact that they're composed of atoms is not what is significant in explaining how an organism functions. To describe an organism from a systems perspective, you want to ask about what are the functional systems, smaller level functional systems that maintain its, allow it to function the way they do. Back when you're in high school, I suppose biology teachers still always say that you're really a bag of water with 17 cents worth of chemicals in you. And I'm sure with inflation, it's maybe $1.70 at this point. But it makes the point perfectly. You just take a bag of skin and dump it in the water and the chemicals, you're not going to get any kind of living organism. And so just as Sellers and Van Deulen were pointing out, what you really have to take account of is the patterns of organization. And then it's not just patterns. You can't just create something heart-shaped and stick it in there. It has to be a functioning circulatory system in order for the organism to be alive. So when you get to the level of biology, you're explaining why the thing works the way it works in terms of these very complex components which themselves are functional systems, and their functions are interrelated with other systems and so forth. And by that time, of course it matters that we're made out of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, etc. Although there's speculation that maybe there could be life that's based on a few other elements. But so far as we know, we're all made of the same stuff. The atomic and chemical level explanations are less and less relevant as you get more and more complex organisms.
I think this will be our last question.
So I'm not a biologist, so I'm just with the imagination. I've read that developmental biology is very different than complex systems, as I imagine all human biology would be, but because cells start out as being pluripotent, and they can become any number of cells, but eventually they settle into their specific roles, brain cells, skin cells, etc. I'm wondering, have you worked at all with developmental biologists, and what kind of things do they have to say about emergence and etc.?
I have not worked with people on that topic, but I'm following mathematician and neuroscientist Alan Scott, who says that this is a paradigm change that really cuts across all of the sciences. It's been being used in city planning, study of insect populations, and it's obviously highly relevant to developmental biology, because whereas it used to be thought that you could that the way we turn out is basically determined bottom up by the genome that we inherited, we now know that genes do their thing and produce proteins, there are all sorts of feedback loops going on that turn some genes on at some particular times and so forth. And so I don't see how you could do by developmental biology without employing these ideas.
If I can't leave the excuse, my neurons need to be good. Can I say my colony may be here?
I'll pay for an ask.
Well, I'm the hardest on other systems.
Yeah.
I'm not
thinking myself. Remember, I have to do this too quickly, but there's the progression from an ant colony, which is about as intelligent as a sponge, up through the lower organisms, till we get individuals with brains, nervous systems, etc. And we get increasing capacities to take in information from the environment. We have an increasingly complex repertoire of behavior. And the main thing is the ingredient that I get from McIntyre. What creates your moral responsibility is the fact that you have the capacity, after you've done something, to say, now, why did I do that? And did I do that for a good reason or a bad reason? And if you decide that it was for a bad reason, then you have the capacity to make plans for the future such that you will be less likely to make that bad decision again. And I think it's there some of the issues of legal responsibility, because I think that one of the questions we have to ask when someone has some sort of neural deficit is whether that person has the other capacities in place to say, okay, I have a neural deficit. Am I going to be able to plan my life, to structure my life in such a way that I can protect myself from falling victim to the kinds of destructive things that I might otherwise do? So, for instance, am I savvy enough to put myself within a community structure that's going to help me make decisions when I know that my own decision-making capacity is defective?
So consciousness makes the difference?
Well, consciousness is presupposed, but my cat's conscious, but I don't hold her morally responsible because she doesn't have the capacity to ask herself, why do I keep doing these things that makes me insane? Maybe she would stop that if I would keep doing those things.